No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join, call in and be part of the conversation. Call in at 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype questions if you prefer to BBSRADIOPR. First, let me say hello to my co-host, Maria. Maria, how are you doing?
Hello, Senator. This is 3 weeks today that I've been self-quarantined.
Oh, my God.
And that was because I flew to San Francisco and attended a conference for 3 days and then flew back home out of San Jose. And that was before all of the cancellations, obviously. And in San Jose, I had a full body pat down by a TSA agent, five of whom subsequently tested positive. The most in the country, aside from JFK, had five also. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to stay close at home in case I got it or, you know, can transmit it. So I actually had my son and daughter-in-law. They came over this afternoon through the side gate into the backyard, and we sat outdoors for almost 2 hours chatting, and it's the first time they have seen a human being also.
Wow, that's so strange. Yeah, we're in the same situation. I've got my daughter, Mary, home, who, you know, is self-quarantined, staying away from me.
Oh, so she came home, though, huh?
Yeah, she did.
Oh, nice.
And Nicholas, who worked every day in a hardware store. I'm not sure why Ace Hardware is an essential business, but it is. And he was going in every day, and he took a 2-week furlough so that he wouldn't be around so many people. Because, as you know, I'm a diabetic, and,
right.
And so we want to keep it out of here. But, yeah, what a strain. Let's hope this is not the new normal. But we have a great guest tonight, Ed Lazier. Ed has been on our show before. For many years, Ed's been the head of the D.C. Physical Policy Institute, which deals with budget issues, those especially affecting low and moderate income people. He's a great guy, and he's done great service to the District of Columbia, and he's very, very, very well respected on the issues which his organization focuses on. But recently, Ed has resigned from his position because he's going to run for a seat on the city council. So we want to talk to him about Corona and what it's doing to his constituents, the groups that he focused on, and also what it may be like to try to run an election, a campaign in the midst of all this. So welcome back to the show, Ed. We really appreciate you being on.
Hey, now I remember why I'm on again. You was such a wonderful introduction, Senator Brown. Nice to be on the radio with you and Maria. Maria, my best wishes to you. Hope that everything continues to be okay with you.
Thank you. And so, how are you going to be campaigning?
There are lots of ways to campaign and lots of different parts of campaigning. So, part of campaigning is fundraising, and every candidate who has to fundraise gets on the phone and just call time, whether there's coronavirus or not. There's also a lot of just building relationships with community leaders, and ideally that's done face-to-face in someone's office or place of worship or a coffee shop, but we can do those by phone. We're going to have our first town hall, probably using Zoom this Thursday night, and we're going to talk about what I think the city's response to protecting the well-being of our residents should be in the middle of this crisis, both health and economic security. And we're going to see how well we do, but we're hoping, we're going to announce it soon, and we'll be on Zoom Thursday night, and as many people as want to join us can. We've also had people already offer to do virtual meet and greets, which also could be by Zoom, but a chance to meet, connect with supporters and their neighbors, if not directly in person, at least we'll be able to see each other. So there are things you can do. It is not quite the same, but I guess I honestly feel like the obstacles I face to campaigning are really not that significant compared to the obstacles that so many other people have just to surviving day-to-day right now, the people who are out of work because their workplaces are closed and they were not salaried employees, the unfortunate half of folks who aren't guaranteed an income from their job day in and day out. I talked to the head of the hotel union recently, and he said that many hotels are at 2 or 3% capacity and have essentially laid off all of their staff. And those are the people who are really worried about how they're going to, make ends meet during this crisis.
Well, let me ask you, Ed, we're proud of the fact, I think, that we had Dr. Crossland on our show a couple of weeks ago, and she's a street doctor. I don't know if you know about Dr. Crossland, but she practices street medicine in the District of Columbia, and she's out there every day with homeless people. Today, they had an article in the Washington Post about homeless people, how they're being affected by the virus, because they're not, they're in between, really in between a rock and a hard place, right? You don't want them in the shelters necessarily, and they travel all around the city, so they have great potential to spread the virus. So how do you think that the constituencies that you work with, low and moderate income people, things with, like poverty and homelessness, all the things you care about, how do you think the city can better serve these people? I know that the mayor has taken some action, but what else do we need to do?
Yeah. I mean, I will say the mayor and council have acted pretty quickly, even well before Congress passed their package to do things like expand unemployment insurance. But there's a lot more to do. And in fact, one of the things that my campaign has already commented on is our deep concern, my deep concern, that people who are experiencing homelessness, many of whom are physically frail to begin with, in part because of their life in homelessness, they're going into shelters and sometimes staying all day, but then sleeping in bunk beds that are, no way 6 feet away from each other. Right. And some communities have taken steps to open up facilities, like public facilities that are big, or use hotels to help make sure that homeless residents are not are able to do the social distancing that everybody else is trying to do, or that the CDC recommends. That's what I think the city should be doing now, is making sure that they are finding a way to find additional shelter space temporarily to make sure that people who are experiencing homelessness aren't put at any more risk than other people. I'm also very much focused on where the gaps are in what the federal government has passed and what the city has passed and who's still left behind. And there are big gaps, and it's not surprising, but we should be doing something about it. And, one example that comes to mind are all the people who do work as independent contractors, which includes most people who are in the gig economy, like Uber and Lyft drivers. They're not eligible for unemployment insurance because they're not employees of their company, or even that's not the way they're treated. They're treated as independent contractors. So we know that Uber and Lyft drivers are not making very much money, but they can't qualify for unemployment insurance, which is, of course, an incredible lifeline at a moment like that, like this. And I think the district should be taking steps. It has expanded unemployment insurance, but not yet to include those workers, and they just need to do that as soon as possible.
Well, I have two questions in that regard. First of all, we're a very wealthy city. We have a $15 billion budget this year, $15 billion plus. But a lot of that money comes from taxes on millennials, people that use restaurants, you know, people that use the services that you were talking about, Uber and Lyft and other things, hotels, tourism is a big, not only a big deal in D.C., but this is our big season, right? The cherry blossom festival, they cordoned off the cherry trees the other day. So what do you think this is going to do to our budget? You're a budget guy. Is this going to have a dramatic impact, you think, on the budget?
Oh, yeah, 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 for sure, right? I mean, it's, you know, all the taxes we raise are based on economic activity, so buildings that are bought and sold or businesses that are selling things, business profits, individuals with earnings. It is true that unemployment insurance income is taxable income, but unemployment insurance doesn't replace everybody's lost wages, so there's no doubt that the city's revenue estimates are going to be changed very soon and, you know, drop dramatically, which means that all of the things that we're planning to spend our resources on now are going to be hard to fund. We, you know, the federal bailout is going to make some of a difference, but as you know, Senator Brown, you probably Maria as well, the Senate, the bill that was crafted by the Senate that the House really didn't have any option to modify, screwed the district by saying we get a minimum guarantee of $500 million when every state is guaranteed $1.25 billion. And that's just outrageous. As you know, we have more residents than a number of states. We certainly have more coronavirus cases, more COVID-19 cases than many states. We have the same needs as every state. We shouldn't be treated any differently. So I think that all D.C. residents should be acting in anger now, reaching out not only to you, Senator Brown, and our delegate in the House, Eleanor Holmes Norton, but to the leaders in the House and Senate, the Democrats in particular, to say that this has to be fixed and that in the next round, because there will be a next round of congressional support, the district needs to get its full share. Because if we do that, if we get $1.25 billion, that will go a long way to offsetting the loss of income tax revenue, the loss of sales tax revenue that we know is going to come as a result of this crisis. And we shouldn't, you know, the goal, really the goal for both how the Congress responds and how the district government responds should be to maintain as much as possible. Whether it's our schools, our libraries, our hospitals, nobody wants to see any of those things reduced. And we should aim to maintain them as much as possible.
Well, given that, let me ask you a really pointed question here. You know, you're right about all this, Ed. It's terrible that the district has once again been treated with second-class citizenship status. But the thing that gets me about it is that this always seems to surprise the District of Columbia, the city council, and the mayor. You know, they've been treating us like this for 210 years, and longer than that, actually 219 years, and we put $200,000 a year into grants to lobby on Capitol Hill, yet we spend $14 million in grants for Arts and Humanities. I have no problem with Arts and Humanities grants, but really, we spend 1.5% as much in going up there and trying to effectuate change, important change. As you just pointed out, this could cost us $750 million. And I wonder what you think about that. Shouldn't we be putting more resources into our fight to become equal? And shouldn't we, I've got to add this because it's very frustrating for me, shouldn't we support the people that have been elected to go and do that?
Absolutely. I mean, we most certainly should be making every effort to reach statehood. And I think this latest round, you're right, it's true. It happens over and over again, although I think this is particularly egregious because we know that it's not that the district itself, government, is suffering. When the district doesn't have enough resources, It's the people who will suffer. It's the businesses who will suffer. And when the package is $2 trillion, to not give the district $750 million is just, it's immoral, it's shocking, it's wrong. I don't know the right words to use for it. It's terrible. I am hopeful that it will get fixed. But yes, it is, just as this crisis is really highlighting how unequal our society is and how our economy really is rigged against so many people, this particular incident is also hopefully a really shocking reminder to every single D.C. resident that if, you know, when they ask that question, oh, what does it mean if we become a state? Well, today, meaning becoming a state would mean be worth $750 million overnight, and that we all should be fighting for statehood, and the district should be putting up the resources that it needs to help make sure that fight is as strong as possible.
Well, and, you know, I might just add to that, that when we look at this closely and we see that it really seems premeditated, you know, sometimes they just forget about us, but sometimes they're out to get us. And this really seemed like a premeditated act. And I can't help but think that part of the problem in the Senate is that we're so close to passing the bill in the House. As our listeners probably know, we have a bill in both houses of Congress, and we have enough co-sponsors in the House of Representatives to pass the bill. And if it weren't for what's going on now, the bill would come to the floor probably very shortly and be passed. And I think that was part of the motivation in the Senate, is they said, we're not going to treat the district like a state at this critical moment, because it's like our tacit approval of statehood. But of course, that's my own pet theory from being up there and working up there and trying to get these guys to move. So, Maria.
I would think that it's just another reminder that you're like treated so differently. I don't want to use pejorative words that we used to say before about like the stepchild or what have you, because we have so many blended families that behave beautifully, but that you are a child and you're not a full-fledged adult, because these decisions keep being made on your behalf and detrimental to you and your health and well-being as a functioning entity. So I would think it would help fuel more passion, like, this is ridiculous, let's get indignant, it's enough.
Absolutely. And, you know, we all know that the history of this congressional oppression is, you know, partly the fact that the district had been and is a majority black city and is still plurality black city, and just Congress not caring about the black residents of the District of Columbia. And now it seems like it's also just an issue of that we are a Democratic city and Republicans in the Senate, not, as you noted, not wanting the district to be coming anywhere close to being a state. But in the end, it's obviously just a huge denial of democracy, a slap in the face. And I am hopeful that enough people will rise up this week and soon to let the Congress know this is wrong and that we will get it fixed. We'll see, but that's what I'm fighting for, and that's what I hope other D.C. residents are fighting for, too.
Reference something since you – it's funny. I've been getting my Ph.D. since January of 2018, and it's a distance learning model, and Zoom is an integral part of it for class meetings, because the students are all over the United States and, frankly, the world. But since Zoom is getting more and more popular because of this social distancing, there's something known about Zoom bombing, and I don't know if you've heard about it, and you might want to have your people look into it, because our school board meeting that happened to this week, and it's happening more and more and more, and it's terrible, and it's vulgar, and it's pornographic, and it could really backfire.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know if you want to tell me more about it now or later. I've heard the phrase, but I don't know what it means.
So at our school board,
I want to do.
They had a picture of Hitler and started talking about his propaganda. Another school board, it just happened to like 2 days ago, and they had pornography come on. I am not technical. I don't know how to prevent it. I do know that you can take some steps, and some of it is how you circulate the link to the meeting. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is technology. You might be able to put in some blockers into the system before you even open the Zoom meeting.
Okay.
So I would hate that to backfire on you, because people don't know, since they're just getting up to speed with what is Zoom, and I always compare it to a FaceTime on the iPhone or Skype video, so they get that connection. But Zoom apparently didn't expect this either. Mm-hmm. So I don't think within their infrastructure they have the precautions that you should take.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And I would just add that Ed is better liked, I think, in D.C. than most school boards. And so I don't think there are as many people out to interrupt his meeting. But
you never know, because it's not just happening academically. Forbes has been writing about it. It's in the news, and it's just come about in the last in less than a week.
Hey, Ed, I want to go back to something for a second. About the money that's involved here. Is it time for us to dip into the DC Reserve, do you think? For those listeners that don't know, the District of Columbia has a $1.5 billion reserve, but it's under several it's more restricted than would normally be the case, because you may remember at one point the district was taken over by a control board, and as part of the negotiations to get our self-government back, we had to agree to certain restrictions on this fund. Is it time for us to have emergency legislation so we can dip into that fund, do you think?
Absolutely, I do. We're very proud as a city. When we build up the reserves, we brag about them. And then over and over again, when the time comes to use them, we are very reluctant to do that. And, of course, what's the point of having a rainy day fund is, in fact, right, to smooth things over when times are tough. And I don't think anybody alive can imagine a tougher time than what we're going through right now. And as you noted, Senator Brown, part of the challenge is the control board 20 years ago demanded that we create reserves and then set ridiculous requirements that we repay them initially within a year, and now it's within 2 years. But, when times are tough and you need to dip into your savings, there's no promise that you're going to be able to recover that quickly. And so it is hard to use our reserves because of that. So, when we ask for that additional $750 million from Congress, we should also say it's time to stop treating us like a child, as you said, Maria, particularly when the reserves are our money. Congress mandated that we create it, but it's our tax dollars. It's not federal money. And if it's our money, then we should have total say over how to use it and when to use it and when to repay it. And so we should demand that Congress not only make us whole in the next rescue package, but that they change the rules, these 20-year-old ridiculous rules that mandate that we pay back our reserves. But I would also point out that it's not just the Federal Reserve, the federally mandated reserves. The district has several other reserves that it has set up under local law with no congressional requirements or restrictions, and they have the same rapid repayment requirements. And so it's dumb and it's self-imposed in that case. So I also, certainly if I were a council member, one of the things that I would be saying as loudly as possible is, not only do we need to use the reserves, but let's change these rules to use the reserves now and pay them back when we can, not pay them back within a year, which we know is impossible.
I think that's very good advice, by the way. And let me just again go back to one thing about running during this coronavirus thing. The big obstacle for all candidates in the District of Columbia is the signature requirement. What have you guys even thought about that? You're not running in the primary, but you're going to need 3,000 valid signatures, and to get on the ballot. And the rule of thumb is you get twice as many signatures as you need, because our experience, I've run many citywide campaigns, is about 58% of the signatures are good. So if you get challenged, you can lose, you know, you can lose 40% of your signatures, depending on how they're collected. Have you guys thought about this yet? And let me just add to that, why can't we do this online?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and we have been thinking about it and also talking to – so I've reached out to some of the other candidates in my race to get their take. I've talked to the people who are behind – I forget the initiative number now, but the one that we decriminalize certain mushrooms and other things.
Oh, yeah.
They're supposed to be gathering petitions now, and obviously they can't. And I think – there, I also have some very close allies who are, who've created a committee to come up with a set of recommendations that I think are going to come out soon that I expect to endorse, and both about the primary election and what we do to make sure everybody has a ballot in June, but also about petition collections for this fall. And there are two options. One is a temporary change that maybe says candidates don't have to do petitions at all, potentially, if they can show they have enough support through other means, like number of donations, something along those lines. Or, as you said, allow online petition signing. Because, you know, there are so many things you can do online. You can register to vote online. You can register your party online. You can
pay DMV fees online.
Yeah. You can request a ballot online. So if you can do all those things, it's not clear why you shouldn't be able to also get some sort of link that's specific to your candidate, the candidate you want to sign for, go online and prove who you are the same way you prove who you are when you change your address or anything else related to your voter registration and sign up that way. Certainly that makes sense in the short term, and it may make sense as a permanent change as well to make sure that we are getting people on the ballot who want to be.
Well, you know, that in so many states, you can simply pay a fee to get on the ballot. But also, I've done this many times, and it gets harder and harder as time goes on. People are more suspicious about signing things on the street. Before this, it's getting harder and harder. And I think that this is going to be so hard.
You know, the one thing, yes, certainly now, the one thing I have said in the past, and from the experience I had running for the first time 2 years ago, is getting your petitions in is a sign that you have supporters. Because when I ran in 2018, everybody who collected signatures for me was a volunteer. That means I had to have a lot of friends willing to put in a lot of time standing outside in the heat to gather petitions for me. And I do think it's a hurdle that is worth at least thinking about whether it makes sense to maintain as is when times are normal, because if you don't have a party of people around you helping you gather signatures, if you don't have those set of allies, that is a sign that perhaps you're not quite ready to run or that you don't have the base of support that a candidate should have. So I wouldn't immediately dismiss the petition gathering process permanently, but I think certainly in the short term, we have to come up with something different. Because it's impossible, and it's not fair to expect people to get signatures when they can't be on the street and they can't be within 6 feet of other people.
That's right.
The pen itself, right? Because I was thinking you could leave a clipboard somewhere, but it has to be supervised, so that person has to be 6 feet away. But then who's going to want to grab a pen that somebody else has just touched?
That's for sure. That's true.
It's true. And I agree with you. You know, as a person that has collected literally thousands of my own signatures over the several times that I've run, yet there was also a positive aspect for me of actually meeting people and talking to them. And you know what I mean? It's like a meet and greet on the street, but it's very, very hard to do sometimes. And I would think now almost impossible.
Yes.
So let me ask you, how about things like poll workers? How about, you know, are we going to have people at the polls? In other words, they just modified the Board of Elections. You may have heard about this yesterday, has just modified things so that they have they're requesting people to do mail-in ballots, but you have to request that ballot. In some states, you don't have to request it. It's sent to you automatically, but here you have to request it. They're also opening up two early voting centers in all eight wards to make it easier, and they're talking about staggering people by last name, I guess. You know, like, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, Ed, the gas rationing when, you know, when if your car was an even number, you went on Monday, and if your car was an odd number, you went on Tuesday, that sort of thing. So have you guys even thought of it? What are you going to do at the polls? Time to put up a lot of signs, I would say.
It's tough. I mean, it's going to require a lot of creativity. I do think the idea of just mailing a ballot makes a lot of sense. If they're only going to have 20 precincts open, as they said in the June primary, and if we are still at a period where the crisis is, where we're still in the crisis, people may not even want to go to those 20 polling stations for the reasons that you mentioned, and it may be hard to find volunteers to work at them. In that situation where we're clearly restricting the access of people to vote in person, it seems to only make sense to say that everybody should get a ballot in the mail. Clearly marked in
vote
a way
by
that
mail.
They know that it's coming. Yeah. Or vote
well,
button.
And another thing that you probably know well, Ed, is that as we gear up for this, and you know, you used to have to go in person to request an absentee ballot, and you had to have cause. I did this once because I worked on the first Obama campaign, and their primary in Pennsylvania, where we were working, was at the same time as the D.C. primary was. So I had to go in, fill out an application. So that's one thing. Now you don't have to do that anymore, but D.C. voters really aren't used to voting by mail. So that's going to be a problem. And another problem is our Board of Elections has problems. They have problems all the time. So are they going to be able, let's say we get 300,000, you know, in a general election, we get 350,000 mail-in ballots. Are these guys going to be able to process them? That would be a worry for me.
Yes, it's a lot to work through and a lot to worry about.
Well, I'll just turn to California. We've been voting by mail forever, and we process it just fine. So the county clerk and recorders, I'm sure, would share their brain trust with how they do it and how it gets, you know, counted and affected. And you just go log online and you change. Because I used to vote by mail only until the Hanging Chad debacle in Florida. And so then I decided I wanted to make sure that my ballot looked clean in person. So now I've been voting in the polls, but this election I was supposed to be in San Francisco in California this month. And so I went on and clicked vote by mail and I got my ballot in the mail. But I turned it into a polling place because we had early polling places too in California. I physically turned it in instead of mailing it.
Well, you can do that here too. It's just that, we have a few problems with our Board of Elections. And so I worry about that. But let me ask you, Ed, why are you running? Why are you doing this again? Why did you leave? You know, you've had such a successful career at the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. What motivates you to dedicate yourself full time to getting elected to this position?
Well, the thing that motivated me to essentially start and run the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute for 20 years is actually the same reason that I decided to leave and run for office, as odd as that may sound. You know, I've been in the city for over 30 years, and this is where, you know, every major life event for me has happened as an adult: getting married, having my children, buying my first and only house, getting connected to a religious community, sending kids to school. Like, it's just, it's my home, and I love it. And over 20 years ago, I decided that I wanted to shift my career focus, which had been on national issues related to poverty and equity, to focusing on my own hometown, knowing that there was so much inequity surrounding me every single day. And so I really was honored to to found the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute and run it for 20 years. And for the listeners who don't know, the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute engages in research to highlight the city's biggest challenges, like the fact that 10 years into an economic recovery, unemployment among black residents has not recovered from the last recession. And now, of course, it's getting worse. And the Fiscal Policy Institute would use that information to then push for policies that we know improve access to good jobs, good wages, affordable housing, good schools, all things that make the city stronger and more fair. And I'm running for office in 2020 like I did in 2018 because I am deeply, deeply concerned about the fact that our prosperity is coming at a cost. You know, the most prosperous city in the country should not be, and doesn't have to be, the place that also is ranks worst in terms of displacement of black residents as we do. We just need to do something about that. And I think if we collectively put our will together, we can, in fact, make sure that everyone who wants to stay here can. We can make sure that our schools are strong and that every child has the chance to succeed. And I think being a council member would give me more leverage to do that. It gives me the opportunity to directly be involved in the policy making of the city and directly address the concerns that D.C. residents have. Being an advocate has been wonderful. It's been a blessing. It's been a great opportunity. But I think I would also like to have a more direct role in tackling the city's problems at the level that I think they really demand.
Well, you know, I have to say that I understand that completely, because when I ran for the first time for a citywide office, it really, really struck me when I was when I spent a lot of time in Ward 7 and Ward 8 on the other side of the Anacostia River. You know, I live in Ward 3. My kids went to great public schools. It really is an eye-opening experience. I went to schools in Southeast that I wouldn't have let my kids walk into those buildings. They were so dilapidated. You know, it wasn't even the quality of education they were getting necessarily. It was just, I just couldn't believe it compared to the schools that my kids went to. And we really are two cities here in Washington, and it really is a shame. So, yeah, you have my support, and I hope the support of other Washingtonians in your quest to make things more equal, because it certainly has to happen in the District of Columbia, especially as we seek equality with the rest of the nation. You know, we should walk the walk as well as talk to talk. So let me ask you about this. Since I've been elected, 7 members of the 12-member city council have either gone to jail, resigned from office, or been beaten for re-election in the midst of allegations of their malfeasance. And we hear this all the time when we go to Capitol Hill. It's the first thing the Republicans say to us. When we had a markup for our bill in the House, they talked about good old Jack Evans and Harry Thomas and Michael Brown and Kwame Brown. They went on and on and on. So what do you think about the corruption on the D.C. City Council? Do you care to address that?
I think you and I and all everyone listening agrees that we should only be electing people with the highest level of integrity, and we should be moving quickly when there are any signs that they're not. I think it is shameful that Jack Evans was able to stay on the council as long as he did. You know, he was pushed to resign, not just the head of the Metro Board, from the Metro Board entirely in the summer of 2019, and it took until early 2020 before he had to leave the D.C. council, and only when his other colleagues threatened to expel him. And they should have moved much quicker. And I think if we really want to maintain the credibility of the institution of the D.C. Council, and we want the trust of D.C. voters, they need to see that we're acting faster than that. And I also think it's shameful that Jack Evans is running for the seat that he just resigned from. And I hope that my preferred candidate, Jordan Grossman, in Ward 2, is elected in the June primary and the special election that comes shortly thereafter. I am eager to be a council member and be a person of integrity to represent the district, and as I have done for 20 years, fight for things that matter for D.C. residents, not for my own personal gain. And it's why I also support changing the law that does not allow any council member to have outside income. It makes it too easy to be doing influence for the people who are paying your paycheck to try to influence policy to support them rather than the residents of the District of Columbia.
Well, absolutely, because it's an honor to be elected, and with that honor goes great responsibility. I agree with you about having outside employment. You know, if you can't struggle by on $130,000, $140,000 in the District of Columbia, I understand that. But do something else for a living. Don't, you know, if you want to be a council member, Maria, we are the highest paid city council in America, with the exception of Los Angeles.
I was going to say.
Which
they're like 175, I think. Right?
Yeah, and they represent five times as many people too.
Yeah, and we just got one of our own busted for taking money. And I actually happened to know him personally. I was part of a group of 10 that rode to Sturgis in 2012, and he was one of the 10. And the worst is that they talk about not only the bribes that he accepted, but the female escort service, and he's a married man. And it's like, oh, God, this is just... He just pled guilty on Friday. So, but
and
we haven't had...
It's given a bad name to bikers.
We haven't had something like that, not like you guys do, for a while, although we did have our former sheriff. But, oh, yeah, that's another story. But I'm curious, because you already know what this is about, and the fact that you're coming back for more and you step down as executive director of the DC Fiscal Policy Institute, you've got all of your skin in the game.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I decided 20 years ago that I was going to devote the rest of my career to making DC a stronger, fairer city with a better quality of life for all DC residents, but particularly for the residents who have been left behind. And that's what I did at the DC Fiscal Policy Institute. And yes, I'm willing to risk or leaving the job that I love for 20 years so that I can serve DC residents in an even better, stronger way. Yeah, I'm totally in this game, and I am confident in this race, but I also know that between now and November, 7 months away, I'm going to be working hard every mm-hmm. single day, and how hard I work and the number of voters I reach out to is really what's going to be important to my succeeding. But yeah, the whole skin and everything inside that skin is in this game.
What did you learn from the campaign 2 years ago that you're going to apply now?
I learned a lot of things. I mean, I think first and foremost, I really fought last time around to be myself. You know, some handlers will say, you know, in every audience, say you care about seniors and affordable housing and schools, and without saying anything meaningful behind it. And I've never been that kind of person. I've been, you know, sort of a policy wonk and at risk of getting into the policy weeds at times. But I really fought hard last time to be myself, to say what I cared about, and what I thought was important for the city. And it was really, really reassuring when I was knocking on doors and saying that I was concerned about the loss of affordable housing and homelessness, that people were like, And, you know, it was so much aligned with what D.C. residents cared about as well. I remember people telling me, yes, my child teaches in D.C. public schools and cannot afford to live in the city. That's wrong. Or, you know, I'm seeing tents that are popping up all throughout the neighborhood, and I think it's a shame that that's the way some people have to live. So that was very reassuring. In terms of lessons learned, beyond that, in terms of just being myself, I did learn that as many people as you think you know, there are way more people that you don't. And it's really important to use your campaign to just be out there at community meetings, ANC meetings, and particularly knocking on doors, that one-on-one voter contact is the main way to reach voters, and I want to do as much of that this time as possible. And then maybe the final thing I learned is, I think a lot of us are sort of taught to be immodest, and I think I put myself in that group. When you're a candidate, you don't want to just go and say you're good. You actually have to say, I'm the best candidate, and here's why I'm good, and why, in fact, these other folks aren't as good. You really have to distinguish yourself from the other candidates, and not in a way that's mean or rude, but in a way that's a lot more direct and a lot less modest than most of us are used to being. But I am ready to do that. I do think having spent 20 years getting to know people and community organizations across the city, 20 years winning victories with those people, 20 years getting to know the D.C. budget, that in fact I am the candidate who's most qualified and who can step in on day one and not have a learning curve, but really be ready to legislate and help lead the city.
Nice.
Well, I got to tell you, Ed, that's such a, the last thing you said is so important. I worked for several years training Native Americans who wanted to run for public office. And we trained, I think we trained 35 and like 28 of them got elected. We were very successful at it. But this was their biggest problem, is that they hate to talk about themselves. They're very, very humble people. And it took a lot of training to get them out there and rewriting their stump speech and, you know, and digging into their background to find out what they had done in their lives that they should have been highlighting that they didn't, you know, necessarily talk about. So that's a really important thing. And I hope you can do that because, you're a great guy. You've done some really great things for the city. And I think people that know you would all say that. You know, I've been in politics for 40 years. I've never heard anybody say anything bad about you. And that's really an accolade, I got to tell you. Because, there are people that say mean things about Mother Teresa in Washington, you know, that anybody. So that really is an accolade. But we're running out of time. I want to do something at the end of the show. I wrote something for Facebook. On Facebook about the coronavirus, and it's getting some play, and I want to read it.
But I want to let Ed give listeners the website.
Absolutely. Yes. Yep. Give us your website.
Yeah. Well, the best way to reach my campaign is it's ed4dc.com with the word for spelled out. So it's edfordc.com.
And it's a good one.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love my web designer.
Yeah. And that's my advice. If your intent in the campaign is to reach out to people, have good social media people and have a good direct mail consultant.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, those things are going to be very important to your campaign. But thanks, Ed. And as the campaign progresses, maybe come back again and talk to us. We really appreciate you coming on today. We wish you continued success
and good luck.
Yeah, good luck. And we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much. Well, good luck to you and, health and safety wishes for everybody
exactly.
who's listening as well. Take care.
Thank Absolutely. You. Thank All you. Right. To you and your family, Ed, too.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
You know, this is unprecedented for us because we usually, Marie and I, don't editorialize. As a rule, we want to hear what people out there have to say. We really don't want to hear ourselves talk. But I wrote something. I've just been, you know, like everybody else, Maria, I've been cooped up in the house for a couple of weeks. And as part of that, I'm starting to reflect on all this and trying to figure out what we can learn from our captivity and you know, how to move in a forward direction. And so I wrote this thing the other day, and people have responded very positively to it, and I'd like to read it, if that's okay with you.
Sure, of course. And we should let our listeners know how agitated you are, because your chair has been in squeak mode.
I'm sorry. We're gonna put together a GoFundMe page so I can buy a squeaky chair. I promise
to
replace this chair.
You can tell how agitated the center senator is by how often it squeaks.
It is old and squeaky. Let me read this to you.
Sure.
As I sit here at the end of my first week of self-imposed quarantine and ponder the immediate future, I realize that there are some very tough choices that will have to be made in the coming weeks and months. At times like this, I think about the basic principles that guide me, and I reflect on that which is closest to my heart. Most recently, I have turned to a favorite passage from Ecclesiastes. To everything, there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. While this is surely a time to refrain from embracing, it is also a time to gather together. To meet the challenges ahead, we need to unite behind a collective will with the kind of courage and resolve that has always sustained us as a nation. I think about my parents' generation, who suffered through the great influenza pandemic of 1918, where my mother lost a sister, then faced the Great Depression and a world war. In the end, they not only survived, they beat fascism, saved the world for democracy, and built the greatest economy with the biggest middle class that the world had ever known. This is what America is, not a place that needs to be made great again, but rather a country that has always been great and whose greatness is most profound in times of hardship. Our nation was founded on the principle that its greatness resides in its citizens, not in institutions or government, but in us. In all these years, the trust that the founding fathers put in the people has always proven to be enough to face any challenge. We must not forget this. We don't need to sacrifice the elderly for the sake of capitalism, for these are the people who built the economy. We also cannot ignore those who labor every day to make ends meet, for they are the ones who sustain that economy, or our young people, for they are the ones that will inherit it. This is a time to gather our stones together and face whatever lies ahead with the same courage, determination, and ingenuity that has always characterized America. To ask not what America can do for us, but what we can do together to remain that shining city on a hill and lead, as our forefathers have always done, boldly into the future. That's the way I feel about it. I hope America feels the same way, and that we can be strong and safe and move together in a positive direction.
Nice, Michael. I didn't see that.
Well, you know what? And I make a promise now to Maria Sanchez, because I know this annoys her and I don't hear it, but I will replace the squeaky chair before I come back on the air. And tonight, you know, we usually play a song. I'd like to play a song tonight, a special song. And this goes out to all the doctors, nurses, first responders, ambulance drivers, medics, police officers, volunteers, the store clerks who are out there,
yep.
the night stalkers, the delivery guys, the public works people who are still keeping all our cities going. This song goes out to all you.
And we should just reach out a little bit once more. If you are listening and you are experiencing any sort of ramifications, not physically but psychologically, now is the time to really reach out to somebody, be it a friend or a family member or a licensed healthcare provider. They're doing telehealth. Some of it is even for free now because so many people are with the isolation or the fear, or they've lost somebody's or what have you. It's really important to not push this aside psychologically, because it can damage us moving forward if we don't deal with trauma when it's inflicted as soon as manageable. And I just, it's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of being a human being. And I just want to empower everybody to do so if you need to. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yes. And reach out not only for yourself, but for the people around you. We've called elderly neighbors this week, and I encourage everybody to do that. And what Maria, exactly what Maria said, in D.C., they're even setting up phone trees for, you know, just regular people to call and check on. If you've got a relative, you can sign up, and people will call them to just check on them and chat with them. And, yeah, let's stay connected as much as we can.
Exactly.
That'll move us forward. So yep. Thank you, Maria. We'll see you next
thank
week.
Thank you, Michael. And let's have a safe, healthy, and flatten the curve week.
Yes, absolutely. And again, this song goes out to all of you people out there that are working hard to make things better for all of us. Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.